This is the Horse Radio Network.
What a beautiful day for horses in the morning.
Well, good Thursday morning, everybody. I haven't said that in a while, and I am Glenn the Geek from Ocala, Florida.
And I am Dr. Rebecca Jimenez from Macon, Georgia. You are listening to Horses in the Morning on the Horse Radio Network for July 18th, episode number 704. This episode is brought to you by Technical Large Animal Emergency Rescue at TLAER.org. Good morning, horse world.
No need to panic, folks. It's Emergency Preparedness Day on Horses in the Morning. That means Dr. G from Technical Large Animal Emergency Rescue is here to enlighten and inform. So put on your emergency gear and mount up.
Well, good morning, Dr. G.
Good morning, Glenn.
Thank you so much for joining us here today. I just want to explain a little bit about what's happening here. Obviously, we have not been live on Thursdays for a little while since Jamie got pregnant. But as I explained on the show yesterday, we will start doing, over the next 4 to 6 weeks, we're going to start doing live on Tuesdays and Thursdays again. But we're going to have various co-hosts who are coming in, and we are going to talk about specific things. So Dr. G's been on our show before with the Horse.com segment, and we liked her so much, we said, why don't you come on and actually do a show once a month about emergency preparedness and first aid and animal rescue, that kind of thing, which is your area of expertise, and we'll get in that a little bit. But we think it's going to be exciting. We have several others of these lined up that are going to be starting over the next couple of weeks. So we'll be phasing out, you know, the reruns and things that we usually do on Tuesdays and Thursdays, and Tune Tuesdays will be phased out. And hopefully we'll have 8 different segments that we'll do every month, and Dr. G is the first one. So thank you so much for being the guinea pig.
I'm excited to be here, Glenn.
Well, you know, we've had you on before, and we've absolutely loved the segments. And I think people are really curious about what not a lot of us think about or know what to do in emergency situations. And unfortunately, we don't think about it till it happens. So our goal with these segments over the next several months is to really have people become aware of it and maybe even think about it ahead of time. And I know that's what your whole life is about, but hopefully we can help a little bit here on the show.
Yes, sir. You know, that's actually a rather interesting point. FEMA has done some studies, you know, all the years that they have been trying to get just people to do planning for their families. They've done some studies that show that in our country, it just doesn't happen. People sort of have ostrich syndrome. They tend to think, oh, it'll never happen to me. Oh, I don't live, you know, I live in Kansas. It can't happen to me. And what we've realized over the last 20 years, if you look at the number of federally declared disasters, that it can happen to you. It happens just about everywhere. Somebody can be affected by something with horses just about anywhere in the United States. So we're hoping to change that thought process.
Well, we're glad that we can help in that mission. You know, I volunteer with the Red Cross and have for the last 15 years. And you know, people say, well, you've probably helped on disasters. And I have. And I have helped on, hurricanes and tornadoes and floods. But the thing that the Red Cross deals with every day and the most common disaster, and it's probably true, I wanted to ask you this, the most common disaster for the Red Cross is fires. Because every day in every chapter, every part of the country, there's a fire and a family that's been displaced. Is that true of horses too? Is it fire the most common?
Well, unfortunately, fire is quite common. 2 types of fire that can affect particularly horse people. And the one that we always think of course, is barn fires. But
right.
If you've been watching the news the last couple of weeks with the Black Fire that unfortunately those 19 firefighters were tragically lost in, and also some of the other fires that have been happening particularly in the West since there's such minimal rain this year, There is a constant effort to try to educate people to get their horses, get their cattle out in time, because it obviously takes longer than just tossing your kids and the dogs in the car. You've got to pitch the trailer. You've got to have a plan where you're going to go. Which way is the fire coming? So wildfires are becoming more and more of interest to horse people as well, particularly if you live in those kinds of areas.
Well, very good. We're going to talk about all of that coming up on today's show. Jennifer, what is happening?
On today's first ever Get Your Act Together Emergency Preparedness episode, it's all about the little things. Even if you don't have headline-making natural disasters in your neck of the woods, that doesn't mean you should be sitting on your non-dramatic weather pattern laurels. So stay tuned for the fracas fixing phrase.
Well, very good. Thank you, Jennifer. I have a couple of questions. Let's talk about you first, Dr. G. You've been on our show before, but I know a lot of people may not remember or haven't heard those segments. So tell us about yourself. Did you grow up a horsey girl? Or
I did. I'm actually from Sanford, Florida, of recent knowledge. When I grew up, we were riding like wild banshees through the citrus groves. We swam our horses in the lakes in Central Florida. We absolutely had a wonderful time and a wonderful childhood doing those kind of things, but I had no equine education. I actually had to go to college and graduate school for that. And you have to remember that I'm over 40 now, and you know, there was probably 7 books in the entire library about horses, and I read every single one of them 2 or 3 times, but they didn't have much information in them for real horse people. They had pictures of saddles and pictures of breeds of horses and things like that. But I really didn't learn anything about equines and physiology and anatomy until I went to college and graduate school.
Did you compete at all, or was it just for fun growing up?
I did not. My parents would not allow me to compete. They had seen some folks that were a little bit obsessive compulsive with their showing with their daughters, and they refused to let me show. And actually, that probably is a good thing.
Because you're not obsessive compulsive now.
partially that, and partially, you know, we really couldn't afford it either. But honestly, when I grew up, we couldn't afford it.
Yeah, that's true. That's true of many. That's for sure. So now, what's your doctorate in?
It's piled higher and deeper. A PhD is often referred to that in animal physiology. And actually, it's in endocrinology of equine reproduction. So does that really mean that I'm a sex doctor? No. what it means is that my interest is in physiology of rescue of the organism, looking at how the organism itself responds to rescue methods and techniques, and obviously equine behavior particularly, but large animal behavior in general.
Okay, so you went to college, and you had been with horses and obviously goofed around and had fun with them. You go to college. How do you decide you want to be an animal rescue? Where does that come from? I mean, it's not something that happens very often, I don't think.
That's true. Before I met him, Dr. Tomas Jimenez, which has the last name you'll notice is me, he was my husband for a long time. In 1992, he was interested in disaster response for veterinarians, and he's a veterinarian. And he attended the very first international conference on large animal rescue, along with some folks that you've probably heard of, Dr. Dix Mansman, who is now in North Carolina, and from UC Davis, Dr. John Madigan. And then out in California also, Captain John Fox and his wife, Deborah, who have been instrumental in starting large animal rescue programs with the fire service in California. So in 1992, they all got together in an international conference, and they were looking at trying to pull all ideas from various areas on how to support horses in vertical lifts and do safe extrications and manipulating large animals. And they pulled in ideas from all over the world. And you have to remember, this is not brand new. I mean, when Columbus sailed the ocean blue in 1492, he lifted horses and cattle onto ships. So this is not brand new. We just had to pull it together into a program. So
I never thought about that. They would have had to have slings and pulleys and winches and cranes.
They did. Actually, the Phoenicians, there's evidence of the Phoenicians back over 2,000 years ago, before Christ, actually being able to lift animals into and out of ships. So it's not brand new. It's just that nobody ever wrote it down. Nobody ever put it together in a program. And that's what Tomas did. I was a student working with him by 1994, and I was so interested in him. I married him. So together we developed the program. And what I come from the military side. I'm in the military as well, in the reserves, in the Army. And
thank you for serving, by the way.
Thank you. His unusual combination of academic and veterinary knowledge, along with my military and behavior interests, sort of combined into a great program that was tailored to animal control and law enforcement and firefighters and veterinarians that basically have to deal with these things on a regular basis. I tell people all the time, 911 gets these calls somewhere in the United States. Every single day, somebody gets a call about an animal that's down and needs some help. And it's sheerly dependent on where you live as to whether or not those emergency responders have any training or knowledge in how to respond to these things. So trying to get that information out to people who otherwise don't think that they do animals until you turn over a trailer wreck in their on their interstate in their jurisdiction. Then they realize that they do large animal stuff. So, and really our claim to fame was that we use live animals. We have horses and llamas that have been trained to be demonstrators for the methods that we were working on, as well as mannequins. We do use mannequins as well, but we also use live animals. And so we were able to show that some of the concepts and methods that we were promulgating actually do work in our live animals. And I'm sure you've seen some pictures of some of my horses that put up with absolute amazing things for a treat. They'll do anything for a treat.
Let's just clarify that you don't wreck trailers with your horses in them intentionally.
I do not do that. And really, the last thing I wanted to say about Tomas getting this thing started was, you know, to me, he's the visionary father of large animal rescue because he is the one that really worked hard to get the fire service involved. And even though we have since been divorced, and we actually worked together for 4 years while we were divorced, believe it or not, I totally depend upon his ideas, and he helps me with special projects. Even though he is, quote, retired to go out and ride and drive his horses, I still have him on speed dial. If I need help or ideas, he is really an innovative person.
Do you think that the fire services has there been more interest? Because we have volunteer fire departments all over this country, not just professional, but we probably have more volunteer than we do professional, actually. Do you see them being more interested in learning about it and taking classes on it? I know my brother volunteers in Connecticut. He's a big active volunteer at the fire department there, and they've done classes on large animal rescue from cows, you know, all the different animals, not just horses.
That's true. He was probably working with Dr. Peter Conserva, who's one of my assistant instructors up in Connecticut, and he has been very active in the state of Connecticut with doing these kind of things. Now, that just sort of, yes, there's lots of firefighters that are interested in doing this. The problem is many firefighters, they know instinctively how dangerous animals are. And so in some jurisdictions, people have said, oh, we don't do animals. And that's probably okay until something happens in your, you know,
until that trailer
large
wreck.
Cattle.
Yeah,
or a trailer wreck, or you have a flood, and then you've got people who love their animals saying, please, you've got to help me get my animal out of this area. And they expect you as the emergency responder to be the expert. And then you're starting to look around and saying, who do I know that can help me with this kind of thing? So that's why we've been doing this. And really the people that have set the standard is a young man from the UK, from Britain, Jim Green. He came over and did some work with us in the early 2000s, and he has gone on to completely transform the way that the UK does large animal rescue through the fire service. And actually, I'm thrilled because I'm going to get a chance to see him again. We're both speaking at the 5th International Conference on Large Animal Rescue this November in Australia. So it shows that the effort is spreading globally. In the UK, they are doing what I would love to see here in the USA. They are getting firefighters trained. There's somebody on every single shift that's an animal rescue specialist, and that could be for dogs and cats that get stuck in drains. It could be for an animal that gets trapped in your vehicle. They get training in both small and large animal. Of course, my interest is in large animal.
It's been interesting, too. You talk about the number of these, and regular listeners to the Horses in the Morning show know that since we started this show 700 episodes ago, for some reason, we found an interest in horses getting stuck in various places. So every time we had a news story about a horse getting stuck in the mud or falling in a pond or, you know, needing rescued for some reason, swimming pools are a popular one. we stopped doing it because there were so many. It just got repetitive. Now we only cover the stories where it's something truly unique, like getting stuck in a tire like that one a couple weeks ago. You know, we only cover the unique ones because there are so many of the others. These horses are just getting stuck in everything. And half the time we go, how, if they're in the field, why isn't that fenced off? And why does that even happen? And I'm sure you do that every day. You're shaking your head.
I actually, since you brought that up, I will mention to you about a horse that just happened to fall into a hole about 2 days ago, and her name is Bianca in Virginia. She fell into the absolute worst hole you can imagine. Unfortunately, the people had to bury a horse the day before, and they decided to bury it in the middle of the pasture. And what they didn't realize is when you use a piece of heavy equipment to dig a hole big enough to bury a horse, it leaves something called destabilized soil, which is basically a fancy name for mud.
Yeah.
And poor Bianca fell in the, with all this rain that we've been having, she fell in the grave.
Oh
my God. So muddy, she could not get out. So they actually called the volunteer fire department and got her. They were successful in getting her out. But can you imagine how horrifying that was? But
for the people and the horse. I mean, the whole thing's just icky.
It is icky. And, I mean, it's got to be awful for the owner of the horse that they had to euthanize as well. But anyway, what I do want to say is that is a good example of prevention. A simple fence put up around that destabilized soil would have prevented the problem in the first place. And what a lot of people don't realize is that soil will be destabilized for up to 10 years. So you need to put a permanent fence around anything where you do heavy-duty digging, whether it's to put in, it could be a pipe, it could be a grave. Any of those things need to be permanently fenced off so that that doesn't happen again.
Well, I can tell, Jennifer, everybody knows how icked out I get on the horse.com segment. I can tell that this Thursday segment once a month is going to ick me out in places. I can tell that.
This is going to be a challenge for you, Glenn. Hey, I just wanted to add something to that, too, is it doesn't have to be a giant area of destabilized soil. Right here in our own neighborhood, they've been removing a lot of telephone poles that are no longer used. And the crews come in, they use a giant machine to yank out the telephone pole. They toss a little dirt back on top, and then they leave. Well, unfortunately, when they do that, it leaves destabilized soil in about an 8-inch diameter and about 5 feet deep. And unless you're watching very carefully when you ride down the sides of the roads here, your horse is going to stick his foot into the 8-inch round hole that's 5 feet deep, which we have tried several times. Yeah, so it's not just the big hole you have to be careful of.
You're exactly right. That is exactly right.
Well, and down here, too, in Florida, because it's all sand, we don't really have soil. We have a problem when you ride in the fields or, you know, if you're driving in the fields, the gopher holes are pretty well hidden, too. Or there's a little layer of sand and there's a hole underneath, and all of a sudden your horse's leg, and they're perfect size, they're about 6 inches, perfect round 6 inches, and your horse's leg will just go right down in that hole about a foot and a half. And it just happens all the time here. You just have to be so careful down here in Florida because the sand is so wimpy. It's so destabilized anyway, especially with all the stupid gophers
right.
we have, you know?
I'll tell you another one that's scary that people don't sometimes realize is when you have your water service put in to your property, and some people don't realize that little plastic cover that covers, you know, so you can reach down and turn off the main water thing, it's plastic. And I have heard of horses that have, you know, that was in the pasture. The horse steps down into it. He ends up pulling his leg back. And then the plastic's so wimpy, it comes with the leg. So now he's got that thing hanging on his leg, and he starts, you can imagine, the average horse is going to freak out, because not only did they scare themselves stepping in the hole, now they've got something attached to their leg that they're going to take off and run around with. So, you know, if it's, like I always tell people, if it's a horse, it can get itself in trouble even in a padded stall.
Right.
Maybe we need to get bubble wrap for horses.
Well, I thought about that a long time ago, especially when you pay the vet bill. You think about that every time. Hey, tell us a little bit about how TLAER started.
Okay. Well, we obviously got started trying to provide trainings to veterinarians, and then we had a firefighter come to one of our trainings and said, hey, really, we're the ones one get 911 calls. Why don't you do some training for firefighters? And that's where we got started. We got busy working with firefighters. Then next thing you know, we were talking to animal controls, who animal control officers in this country, Glenn, this is really, it's sad. Animal control officers tend to be people who get put into that position without any training. I joke around with them jokingly, but it's really not funny. I tell them, what kind of training do you get? And they say, well, we get the keys to the truck and we get a catch pole and that's it.
Yeah.
We don't get any training in how to control animals.
And minimum
behavior,
wage, by the way, and minimum wage too.
That's right.
Yeah.
And actually, Florida does a better job than anybody else. They actually have a required 40-hour course for animal control officers in the state of Florida, but they are the only state that I know
of. That's because we have to deal with alligators and snakes that go kill you.
That's exactly right. That's probably why. So what we've done is we've gone on to provide training events at the awareness level, as well as the operations and technical levels, to units and departments and organizations. And what we try to do is bring in some of the cutting-edge techniques and tactics to deal with various scenarios. And as you've already pointed out, the scenarios are just myriad. There's no way to prepare for the next one. I get pictures all the time of things that I've never seen before, and I go, how the heck did that horse end up with that? But really, it's all about keeping the emergency responder, whether it's the horse owner or a firefighter, safer when they're trying to deal with a 1,400-pound animal that wears steel shoes and basically doesn't speak English.
So you guys go around and do training seminars, and I know you also have some online stuff that you do, textbooks and things like that?
Yes, sir. And we've also, the reason I did the textbook is because for years we had collected all this information, and I kept looking back at Columbus and the Ocean Blue in 1492 and the fact that nobody had ever written it down, and I sort of had an idea that I should clear my conscience in case I got hit by a truck. I should write this all down. So that's why I did the textbook, and it's titled Technical Large Animal Emergency Rescue. And I tell people, look on Amazon.com or Barnes & Noble, any of those places online, and you can find it. And if you don't want to get one for yourself, if you don't want to read a textbook about all this detail, buy one and give it to your local fire department. Give it to your local animal control. Give them some of the tools that they can actually put to work, because one of these days it's going to be your horse that they're going to be responding to. And that's probably the best investment that you can make. And then, of course, yes, I also have been working with ResQuip in the UK since 2008. We wanted to get a more realistic training mannequin that weighed somewhere around 500 pounds and was able to stand and bend in all the natural places that a horse or a cow bends, and be able to shove it in places like upside down, overturned trailers, trap it in trees, stick it in the mud, those kind of things, where I don't like to put my live animals. I mean, my live animals will do like lots of demonstrations and lifts and those kind of things, but some of the really technical spots that you want to stick an animal mannequin, I'm not going to do that with my live horses. So that's why we've started doing that. And the last thing that we've been busy on this past year is the NFPA, which is the National Fire Protection Association Standard 1670, which is the standard for the fire service defining arenas of practice and how they should do things. And this is the first time in 2014, it will be published. It's in the comment period right now. And this is the first time that the fire service in the United States will have admitted that they are doing large animal rescue. They're doing it. They need to get smarter about how to do it. So I volunteer lots of time to NFPA. I'm a volunteer firefighter myself, volunteering tons of time trying to educate firefighters, law enforcement, and folks that do emergency response about better ways because when we first started getting into this, the number of people that thought it was a good thing to just slap a rope around the animal's neck and pull it out with a truck was huge. We ran into so many, it's awful. And we don't want people doing that. There's better ways to do things. You wouldn't do that to
a person. Oh, you mean strangling them is not a good way?
No, it's really not. You wouldn't do it to a person pulling them out of a car, so why would you do it to a horse?
Well, that just, and it just goes to show you naivete is the biggest reason for that. It's people who've never dealt with horses and don't know. So the education is the only way to solve
that.
They don't know, and they,
that's right, and they think that they're large, and what we've learned over the years is that animals are medically very fragile. And the best way I've explained it in my classes is if you are in a car wreck, Glenn, and you are trapped and you hear sirens, you're probably going to say, oh, thank goodness, somebody's coming to help me. At that point, if you're a horse inside a trailer wreck and you hear sirens and people showing up, you're thinking, oh, no, somebody's coming to help me. So it's a totally different – that's when they start getting more stressed. They're already stressed and possibly injured from the incident. Now they're going to get more stressed and more scared because the predators are showing up to try to help.
Well, you've set up some terrific guests for today that are going to be on the show here in a little bit. And what we are – going to attempt to do with this show is to once a month, it'll be the first Tuesday of every month, or actually, I'm sorry, geez, it's going to be the third Thursday of every month. You'll be on with us. I don't know where I got the first Tuesday from. I'm rushing things along here. So it's the third Thursday of every month that you're going to be on with us. We really do want to cover, we're going to be talking about in this first half an hour specific things that you can do. It's going to become a much more practical today. We're getting to know you a little bit and getting to know what you do and that kind of thing. But it is going to become a more practical thing and a really kind of a hands-on thing where people can take what they hear on this episode and utilize it at home, practice it, and make it happen. So, and we're also going to be covering first aid, right? It's just not emergency preparation, but first aid for animals and in addition to animal rescue and then getting ready for the hurricanes and tornadoes and fires and all that stuff.
Yes, sir.
We have a lot to cover, seems you like know. There's a lot to talk about.
There is, and it seems like with Google these days and the prevalence of cell phones that some of the, quote, rescues that were going on before that never made the news seem to make the news these days. And my personal opinion is that you can put a picture of a naked horse on the front page of the newspaper and nobody cares. We can't do that with people.
That's true. That is true. You could. It'd probably be bad to sell more newspapers, that's for sure. Hey, one of the other things that you did is you brought some new sponsors that are going to help put this show together every month. Why don't you tell us about our first one?
I will talk today. Today is brought to you with the support of Large Animal Rescue Glides, and LARG Rescue Glides are the most useful equipment to easily and safely move large animals, and especially horses that are down, sick, injured, severely lame, and need to be transported to definitive veterinary treatment. They're really a staple, Glenn, of TLAR teams and racetracks, rodeos, anywhere where people are doing very athletic events with horses. Veterinary clinics world over are using these glides. And let me tell you a little bit about Ben McCracken in Greenville, South Carolina. He's been making these glides for over 15 years, and he's sold them all over the world. He told me one time he got a rush order from Dubai that had to be overnighted, and I don't even want to know how much that cost.
Anyway, these things aren't small.
Yeah. And people from fire departments and veterinarians to profession hauling service are calling him to set up a team, or they want to outfit their ambulances, and even dead animal recovery services for both composting or rendering. It's a much more professional way to have the animal packaged for delivery instead of just, you know, attaching a chain to its back leg and dragging it. So their glides, Tomas and I have been very impressed over the years. We've got one we've had for about 15 years, and they are the standard as far as we're concerned for strength, serviceability, and ease of use. It's the big green, sort of a signature green recycled plastic glide that you've probably seen in pictures. They're durable, they're easy to clean, and it comes with all the accessories. You might want to ask, does your vet own one? It's amazing to me when I run into veterinarians and they say, what's that? And I say, that's a glide. You don't know what that is? And they say, no, I've never seen one. And I'm like, do you live on this planet? Anyway, For sick and injured animals, that's really the only way to safely move them. Whether it's an animal that falls down in the dark of the pasture, in the rain, and you want to move him to the barn, or if you're trying to load him on a trailer to get him to the veterinary clinic. So you can contact Ben McCracken at 864-270-1344, or you can visit his website at Rescue Glides, RescueGlides.com.
Very good. Well, thank you for that. And I think our first guest is ready for today. You want to introduce Kelly?
Of course. Kelly Siegler came to one of my classes in about 2011, and she was there with a bunch of firefighters and law enforcement officers and veterinarians, and she came to me and said, listen, I have realized that the need for this information needs to be synthesized down to the horse owner so that they can expose themselves to information that directly relates to their horse's ability to respond safely and predictably. In other words, they can bring their horse up to a higher level of preparedness. Now, this is something that we'd never done before. We had always been talking about how to rescue animals and how to prevent incidents in the first place. But then I run into Kelly, and she is a 4-star level Pirelli student and a licensed Pirelli 3-star instructor. She has fully embraced these ideas, and now she has developed a curriculum out of our course that is out and running on its own. It's allowing students to get involved with their own horses in prior preparation for emergencies and disasters.
Good morning, Kelly.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Thank you so much for joining us here today. We appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome. This is great. I'm glad you asked me to.
Kelly, we are absolutely thrilled to have you on the show this morning. Can you talk a little bit about maybe take our listeners to what they can expect us to do in your course?
Well, we have a certain agenda, and we go through a lot of different things. And we focus on, I guess, kind of the big pieces, for example, like we focus on barn. What would happen if there was a barn fire? What would your horse experience? And we do things like we put some smoke in the barn. People can see how their horse actually responds or reacts to that, and we teach them how to appropriately evacuate them, you know, the tools that they would need, how their horse would experience firefighter. You know, of course, a lot of these horses don't, they react, they get worried. And so then we take a step back. We show them how to get their horse used to things like smoke, how to get their horse used to things like a guy in a suit with a mask on. So a lot of it's about building confidence in the horse, so when something does happen, the horse doesn't get worried about it. And we also give people a plan on what to do, so if it does happen, they have something and they don't panic. So the barn fire is one piece. We work on trailering and what happens if the worst happens in a trailer, and getting your horse used to ropes and things like that, and they would know what they would need to do if their horse was in an accident, who they need to call and how they need to call them, so they have a plan for that as well. We also talk about things like entrapments, just if the horse got trapped in some wire at the farm, or if they got trapped in something when they're on a trail ride, and how to get the horse out of that, and how to prepare the horse so they don't panic if it happens. So there's a whole variety of things. I mean, it's just a 2-day clinic, but it's a lot of information. We also do things like if your horse gets trapped in a pool, how would you help your horse get out of there? What kind of tools should you have on hand if something like that happens? And these aren't like technical tools. These are just things you can get from Walmart, things like that. We talk a little bit about medical
floaties.
Concerns.
You mean little floaties like the kids wear? Is that what you're talking about?
oh, no, we don't put floaties on the horses.
Okay.
I have all kinds of different sort of floaties.
I know.
But just things like you can get from Walmart, like just a pole. You can drive the horse, or something you might have at the pool, like a little pole with a net on it. And we show people how driving the horse will help influence the horse to move. We show people, like, what not to do. The last thing you want to do if your horse is caught in a pool is try to put a rope on its neck and pull it out, because you can strangle them. And we, you know, we talk about things like that. Just because you might help get your horse out of a situation, you don't want to do it and your horse be so damaged that then you have to put him down. So we talk about what to do and what not to do. Because when people, you know, as you probably know, when they get worried or concerned, they just react. And sometimes they're doing things because they just want this thing to stop, and that can actually not be a good plan to have. So
I think one of the biggest things, you mentioned it earlier, I think for a horse owner, and a horse husband, is one of the biggest things that we worry about is trailering and what happens if there's an accident when the trailer turns over. Nobody really knows what to do in that situation other than panic. We all do that very well, being humans. You don't know exactly what to do. I mean, you've never dealt with that situation before, and it probably, wouldn't you say, is one of the scariest ones that we think about and hope never happens?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And so a lot of what we do is, we talked about prior proper preparation. So how to make sure that your trailer is safely on, how to make sure that you have the right kind of truck for your trailer, sort of a list of what to do before you put your horse in the trailer. And then when you trailer your horse, make sure the trailer is safe for the horse, that they're not too big and your floorboards are rotting away, and how to tie your horse correctly in the trailer. We talk about those kind of things. So if the trailer did flip over, your horse doesn't get strangled because you've tied them incorrectly. So we go through all of those things, and then if the worst does happen, we talk to you about how your horse, what you need to do to help get your horse out. And of course, you have an emergency person come, and you're calm and not acting like the crazy horse owner. They might allow you to help give them some advice if they don't know on how to get the horse out correctly. So, we can go through this.
Kelly, I know that you have got a fantastic story of your own horse in a cattle grate. Can you tell that story?
Yeah. So last summer, and now this is a horse that I've done a lot of training with. He's my level 5 horse, and level 5 meaning he's gone through the whole Pirelli program, and he's kind of done it all, seen it all. And we've done a lot of things with ropes all over his body, which is one of the things we do in the course, and teaching him not to panic if he feels something around his leg or anywhere on his body, but to move away from that pressure, which horses as prey animals instinctively don't want to. They want to push into pressure, and that's how they get themselves hurt. So my horse was on a ranch in Colorado, and did not see this cattle grade, and he was trotting along the road. He probably saw one of his friends, and he fell into it with just his hind legs. He somehow, a big horse, he must have gotten on a couple of them and dipped back in, slipped in. So luckily, I was very close, and I saw him then stuck in there, and I ran over. And the good thing was, because he trusted me and he knew not to panic, he knew to look to me, he relaxed. And then my husband actually saw the whole thing from further away and said, it seemed like an hour to me, but it took about a minute, and he allowed me to get his back legs out and to help him get free. So and most horses, you can ask Rebecca, would end up being stuck. The owner wouldn't know what to do. They'd end up calling the vet or whoever, and the horse would get stuck and probably struggle a lot, end up hurting themselves. Where my horse, he did have his legs looked like they were skinned just from falling through that metal because it was pretty sharp, but he only needed a few stitches and just some bandages to keep that area clean. And the vet actually said, this is the only time I've ever been called out to this kind of situation. I didn't euthanize the horse. So, that's the kind of thing.
Awesome.
And that's what, a horse is a prey animal. They're supposed to panic when things like that happen. So the horse is more worried about, they're more worried about their survival, but they'll kill themselves in the process. Do you know what I mean? So we teach them to do almost what they think they shouldn't do.
So it's pretty much like humans then. It's pretty much like humans then. We panic too. So it's pretty much the same.
You're basically teaching horses to increase their chance of survival. That's mm-hmm. the best way we can explain it. Isn't that awesome?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, the thing about it is we are the ones who put horses in all these situations. I mean, you don't see a horse volunteering to hop in the trailer and go down the road. I mean, that's our choice. So if we're going to choose to put him in a trailer, or, not many horses have decided in their herd to build a barn and live in it. all of these things are things that we impose on the horses, right? So if we're going to do that, we need to make sure the horses are safe and we have as good of a plan as we can. And what is a little shocking to me is that most people think they already know all this information. A lot of them, when I talk to them, and then they take the course and they go, wow, I didn't know any of this stuff. So you know, humans are kind of funny that way, but I'll tell you, this is a really important course, this stuff that, you know, I learned from Rebecca, and I'm able now to put into the horseman's terms, I guess you'd say, has been really powerful. So, yeah, absolutely.
Glenn, I can't tell you how tickled I have been to see somebody of her stature in the horse industry realize how important this is and find a way to get this out to horse owners. And you don't have to be doing anything specialty with your horse. You can go to one of Kelly Siegler's clinics. You can look at her website at kellysiegler.com. Kelly, what's your phone number?
It's 803-522-4395. And yes, I've got a couple clinics on this coming up, and you know, people are more than welcome to go to the website and look at them and contact me if they're interested in coming. And we have, you can come with your horse or without your horse. Everybody gets a manual, which includes all the information that they're going to need to, you know, need to know. They don't even write notes. We even have all the forms they need. For example, like if you were going down the road and trailering and something happened and you were unconscious and you couldn't help your horse, it gives the consent that someone else can save your horse. And the insurance information, contact information for you, and all that kind of stuff. So all of those things are already done, which is worth just the course in itself. You'd have to have a lawyer draw all those up for you. You do all that kind of stuff. It's a good course. Information's on my website, and that'd be great. If anybody ever wants to sponsor one or host one, you know, we're always open to that as well. So, yep.
You know, one of the questions that's come up on this show ever since, or on the Horse Radio Network for that matter, over the last 5 years, and we've had this discussion, and we've never come to a definitive answer because everybody disagrees, and I'll throw it out to both of you, is the old, do I keep the horse in, or do I put the horse in the barn when the tornado or, you know, or hurricane are coming, or do I leave them out? That always has been one of the big questions. You know, obviously the argument is if you put them in the barn and the barn comes collapsing down on top of them, if you put them out, they're susceptible to flying debris, but at least they can, you know, use their own instincts to do whatever to get themselves out of danger. So what's your thought there, Kelly?
In a tornado situation, I mean, a tornado can take away that barn in a second. The horses would be better off being left so that they could get away from danger. And we talk to people about that. We also show them ways of putting identification on your horse. So if the fence blows down and your horse can be identified, and then you'll get them back, because that happens a lot, these natural disasters. The horses get away from home because the fences go down. And they might be 20, 50 miles down the road, and then someone will find them and then can find their owner. So
now I'll play devil's advocate here. I'll play devil's advocate, having, you know, with the Red Cross worked a couple tornado situations.
Yep.
And they would argue that they're better off in the barn because they're less likely to get a 2x4 through the side at 150 miles an hour from flying debris. So that's, you know, that is one of the arguments,
well,
obviously.
I hear you. You'll have to come see some of the slides that we have of what tornadoes have done. And we have one in particular from a barn in North Carolina. It was full of very expensive walking horses, 50 of them. And we have a picture of the barn and the arena. And the arena was a huge covered arena with these big, huge steel beams, you know, into the ground. That thing was ripped out. The hall, the beams were ripped out. Every horse died. So if those horses had been left out, they could have gotten away to where they need to, because horses have, you know, good instincts about things like that. I mean, they will know, you know, where they should go, and they have a higher percentage of surviving than if they would.
I wanted to say, we have a caller on the line, actually, from Georgia. Kelly's in Georgia, and she has a question about tornado preparedness, so this is perfect. But why don't we just take her call right now?
All right.
Good morning, Kelly.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Thank you so much for joining us this morning. What's your question?
My question was, again, for tornadoes, with all the natural disasters that have happened in Oklahoma. My question is, a lot of owners believe that they should let them out of the gates, open the gates, and just let them run. And I'm wanting to know, what is the opinion on that?
I don't know if I necessarily, let them be running all around the county or anything like that, because you don't want them to just go running out in the road, because then that could cause, of course, more hazards. People could run into the horse, and then the horse owner is actually liable if that were to happen. I would let them out in the pasture is what I would do.
Now, the problem with that the problem with that is a lot of people don't have adequate pastures in order for the horses to get away.
Yeah. I mean, the best thing, really the rule of thumb, you know, I hate to say, is to be prepared, you know, to have your pastures where your horses are safe, have, you know, safe pastures, have safe fencing. And the best thing is, we talked about this in the course, is evacuation. Don't wait around. As soon as you have any inkling, you need to put your horse in a trailer and you need to leave. That's harder.
That's easy to say. I'm going to argue with you here a little bit. That's easy to say, having lived in tornado country. That's easy to say and hard to do when it's a tornado. You can do that when it's a hurricane.
And some people don't have but a 2-horse trailer, and they own 6 or 8 horses.
Well, there's an interesting one too, and I'm sure that Dr. G, you deal with that question all the time. That's an actually very interesting question.
I do, and I tell people if you have a 2-horse trailer and you have 6 horses, you pick which two. It's called prioritizing your patients.
That's a tough one.
And it sounds horrible, but I mean,
that's the reality.
What if I have a sports car and only me and one of my kids can fit in my husband? What am I going to do with my other kids? Oh, I guess I'll just leave them. I mean, think about it like that. Oh, God, of course not. I'm going to have a minivan so everybody can fit in. Well, if you're going to have that many horses, you need to prepare to take care of those horses. Like I was saying earlier, we're the ones who put horses in these situations. None of them voted to come live in a pasture, in a barn, and all that. So you've got to make sure that every horse you have is safe. You know, that's something to do as a good horse owner, you know. So, and I know, Rebecca shared a story with me last year about a tornado. Remember that, Rebecca? And you knew the tornado was coming, and you had, you know, on the radar, it was like 30 minutes or something like that. And you told the lady, the horse better go on the trailer right now, or I'm tying it to a tree and we're leaving. That's another thing. A lot of people's horses won't load. And, I mean, I get that all the time. They'll go, oh, well, I never take my horse anywhere, so don't load them. I'm like, well, then, sorry for you. You're not going to be ready when that emergency happens. I mean, all I have to do to load my horses is open the door and point my finger and they go in. That's how every horse should load, because as a responsible horse owner, you need to take the time to train your horse. You need to take the time to teach them to tie, to load, and do all those things. So it's not just about tornadoes or hurricanes. What if your horse got really sick? What if they call it and you had to take them to the vet? You're going to have to put them in a trailer. So that's another thing we talk about, is getting your trailer in really good, and not only you being able to load your horse, but one of the things we do in the course is we have a fireman load your horse. Because if they have to be evacuated, you might not be there. The fireman might have to do it. So they have to be able to load literally by throwing the rope over their neck and going in, not you leading them in. Because a fireman generally won't lead a horse in, because his life is more valuable than the horse's, and he's not going to take that risk to get trampled on. So that's another thing we talk about. And, you know, the course is a big reality check for people. And it just comes down to, well, the more prepared you are, the better off you are. You know what I mean? So.
Hey, some of the horses I've seen that were people have tried to load, I wouldn't get in front of them either. I wouldn't get in front of them either to load them.
Because they're so.
Not just a fireman, I wouldn't either.
Right.
As a responsible horse owner, how would I start to create a plan for my horses?
I mean, that's the whole reason we do this course. That's what that is all about, is we answer all those questions. I mean, it's something that's more than a scope of just like a 3-minute conversation that we have here. But as far as like evacuation, you want to have a plan ahead of time of, if something happens, where am I going to take my horse? And set up with someone, can I bring my horse here if this happens? Okay, that's the first step. Then the next step would be, can my horse load in a trailer quickly? Okay. You've got to make sure your horse can load quickly in a trailer so you can get out of there. And if you don't have a trailer or transportation, you know, you're going to have to try to set that up with someone, but that's going to delay your evacuation. So I would say those are the two big things.
I think you said it best when you said this is not something to be solved in 3-minute conversation, but I will tell you there's a lot of resources online. Kelly Fiegler, we really appreciate you coming on the show this morning.
Well, thank you for
and
me
Kelly
too.
From Georgia, we appreciate your call.
Thank you. Okay. Well, we hope to see you guys at some of the clinics we have coming up, and you can check out my website at kellysigler.com.
Thank you, Kelly.
Okay.
Great to have you.
Okay. All right. Bye.
Well, that was very interesting. You know, and I did want to mention that just like Kelly from Georgia called in, you can give us a call at 347-637-3238. We're here till 10:30, and we'll try and take your call when we can. If you have any questions about this particular topic, that's one of the reasons that we do a live show, is that you're able to call and ask questions, and it's one of the things we talk to Dr. G about. So you can do that at any time. In the meantime, let's take a break. We're still going to play our song. We do it every day, and I thought a good song for today would be Have a Good Life by Jared Rogerson. And then we're going to come back with another terrific guest that Dr. G has set up. So we'll be right back in a couple of minutes.
I swear I wasn't looking. I just turned around and you were there. We spent all night talking about the things that make us shine and how we never wanted it like this. You're an angel, no doubt about it. You can see right through my disguise, and the way that you're flying's got me mesmerized. I know you're something I could never forget. So have a good life, I hardly know you at all. I may never see you again, but what a weekend, I'll miss you so much. I hope you remember my name. You could have been my best friend, but till our trails meet again, have a good life. I'm like that pack of cigarettes. I got nothing you need. So go on living your dreams, and I'll keep chasing mine. Let's don't pretend that I don't have regrets. Have a good life, I hardly know you at all. I may never see again, but what a weekend, I'll miss you so much. I hope you remember my name. You could have been my best friend, but till our trails meet again, have a good life. Bad timing, chalk it up to circumstance. It's over our heads and out of our hands. So have a good life, I hardly know you at all. I may never see you again, but what a weekend, I'll miss you so much. I hope you remember my name. You could have been my best friend, but till our trails meet again, have a good life.
Well, that was Jared Rogerson with Have a Good Life. You can find all of his music at jaredrogerson.com. And next week on Tune Tuesday, actually, we'll be doing a virtual Jared Rogerson concert with all Jared Rogerson music. We did Templeton Thompson this week, and next week we'll be doing Jared. You're listening to Horses in the Morning. I am Glenn DeGeek, and I am here with Dr. G, and we're doing a special show once a month here on emergency preparedness and first aid and things and horses, brought to you by the Technical Large Animal Emergency Rescue at TLAER.org. And of course, Coach Jen is producing today as well. And the show is also brought to you with support of Hest. Hest is the exclusive manufacturer of the Becker Sling and the Hest Water Rescue Harness. The Becker Large Animal Rescue Sling can be applied quickly for short-term vertical lift of animals in many situations, like in when you're getting a farrier done with some animals that they need to be lifted. Also, if you're digging them out of ravines or holes or extricating them from the mud, it's widely used by fire departments, rescue squads, and animal response teams in the United States, Canada, Europe, and Australia. The Hest Water Rescue System is a recent development intended for the disaster scenarios such as a horse trapped in floodwater that just needs support to swim to safe ground. Hest can also manufacture custom webbing for a wide range of uses for individuals, rescue agencies, and veterinary hospitals. Hest is located in Virginia and is owned by veterinarian Dr. Kathleen Becker. You can contact her at their website. It's rescue.hastpsc.com. And I know that's a lot to remember, and you won't, but you can find all of the links to everybody that we talk about today on our show notes at horsesinthemorning.com for this episode. And, you know, are these the slings I'm sure that we see in the pictures and things being used to rescue animals out of holes and ravines and mud all over the country?
Absolutely. There's quite a few slings over the years that we've experimented with, and Dr. Becker actually came to one of our trainings in, I don't know, about 98 or 99. And she said, listen, there's no reason to be struggling with all these other extra straps and all these kind of things. So we started using her as actually to make the kinds of slings that we use. We wanted something that was simple. We wanted something that was engineered to be able to lift the animal safely. You certainly don't want to drop it after you've gone to all the effort of lifting it, and that had good stitching quality, and also that the webbing would actually feel nicely on the skin because you're lifting the entire animal with it. You don't want to rip the skin or those kind of things. So Dr. Becker has been intimately involved in helping us come up with some better products for doing large animal rescue over the years.
Oh, cool. Very good. Now, with these slings, you know, you need something to lift them. So you need a tractor or something like that. Are there situations where that you run into where there's just nothing to lift the sling available?
I'm glad you brought up the tractor. We're not really a big fan of tractors unless it's an absolutely huge tractor with a big boom on it. Because yeah. Think about it, Glenn. When you go to pick up a horse with the forks on just a basic tractor, the horse is going to end up being way too close to the equipment. Yeah. It sounds scary. It vibrates. It's scary. So we are big fans of the four-wheel drive forklifts that have a long boom or a crane or any those great alls. Those are an excellent form of lift. And of course, in our classes, we also teach people how to use overhead things like really heavy duty tree limbs and other high points that you can use to make a lift. And what's really funny is you're right. There's times when you cannot lift it in any other way, shape, or form. So we look for something simple, like is there a way to put it on a rescue glide and slide it out instead of trying to lift it? You may have seen some of the videos that have made it over the years to CNN and other news channels of the Anderson sling. And the Anderson sling is a fantastic sling for medical uses, and it's the only one that we recommend for helicopter uses. But really, come on, how often are you going to try to lift a horse with a helicopter? It's right. Dangerous, it's difficult,
expensive.
It requires a lot of coordination, and it's freaking expensive.
That's
exactly.
True.
So it doesn't happen very often. Now, there is one state in the United States that uses those things quite often. That is California. And they have people who are trained, they have the slings on hand, and they do perform those things. But for the rest of us and the rest of the country, it's really not a real viable option, even in flooding and that kind of thing. We try to find simpler ways ways to deal with those situations.
Most of the harnesses or the slings that we see in these stories and these rescue stories from around the world is fire hose. The firemen don't have a sling.
That's right.
So they end up using fire hose.
That's right. You can use fire hose. You want to use the cotton jacketed fire hose. And we like hose that's about, when it's flat, it should be at least 4 inches wide in width. And that limits the chance of doing damage to the horse, both the skin as well as because of the sheer pressure from the weight. And anytime you lift an animal off of its feet, you should have support of its chest and breast area, as well as the hind end. And it needs to be coordinated in a lift from two pull points. You need to have an animal handler that's controlling the head. And, you know, like you said, you call 911, it is the call that does it all, because they will have that kind of equipment on the fire truck. And the really cool thing about volunteer firefighters and firefighters in general is they never know what they're going to have to deal with today. They, you know, people joke around about firefighters and cops sitting around eating donuts. Well, that's probably because they're trying to figure out what they're going to do on their next call, how they're going to deal with, you know, a trailer wreck is not a trailer wreck is not a trailer wreck. My trailer wreck may look different from your trailer wreck. There was a trailer wreck recently in North Carolina that I got a phone call from. The folks had rolled their big three Mustangs that they just bought from the BLM auction 40 yards down an embankment in the rain as it's getting towards dark in North Carolina in the mountains. They've got a big bunch of water that's just flowing underneath them from a big ditch. The people were fine. The horses are at about a 40-degree angle down the thing. How do you get that out? You're going to have to call 911. And, of course, they called 911. 911 had some ideas on how they might be able to extricate the trailer and or the animals, and they actually were successful. Those three Mustangs are actually going to be in some of the Mustang Millions competitions. They're going to, the family is actually working on educating them and going to be competing in some of these Mustang competitions.
By the way, I wouldn't blame those three Mustangs if they never wanted to get into a trailer again.
You know what's funny? They loaded right up.
Did they?
They loaded right up. Horses don't.
You take me out of the wild and then try and kill me in a trailer? Oh, geez.
That's right. But they don't perceive it as being dangerous. They perceive whatever you're doing to them as being dangerous.
Wow. That's amazing. Well, now, I know you had a couple of stories here, and I liked how you put them in the show notes. Jennifer's having a little trouble getting a hold of the next guest, I guess. Jennifer, she's trying now. I think she's getting voicemail, so she's going to try him again. So let's see here. You had a couple of stories here in the show notes about some fires, and I liked how you put this, you know, the versus stories, one story versus another. And one of them was up in Happy Valley Farm, and this was a saddlebred operation in North Georgia, not too far from you, right?
Correct. This is a really sad story. These folks lost almost all their horses. I think they got one out of the barn. And this sort of goes back to our, it's very difficult. Horses are expensive, and barns and all these other things are expensive. Very, very difficult to try to deal with situations where people want to have animals, they want to show animals, these kind of things, and they're looking at, wow, I'm going to spend $100,000 for the barn. Oh, my God, what do you mean I got to spend an extra $20,000 for a sprinkler system? And going time and time again, when I talk to people who have actually had their barn burned down, they tell me, if I had only known that there was even such an option as having a sprinkler system. But remember that the sprinkler system doesn't work unless you have a good system to detect it in the first place.
Right.
And you want to detect that fire at the smolder stage, which is the learning point from that second story that we were talking about.
Right. I know we've done, we did an episode before, way back in the beginning of Horses in the Morning, where we actually had the people who did the fire sprinkler systems on. And, you know, it was very interesting, the different you know, the different ways they do that, where they the detection is the most important part of that process.
Exactly. The detection has to be there before anything else. And the detector could be a person, and that's what people assume. But really, how many hours are people really in the barn? For most barns, you feed and close up the barn by 8 o'clock at night. You don't go in that barn again until 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning the next morning. Those animals are sitting there for 6, 8, 12 hours with nobody else in the barn to detect that. So that's why you've got to have automatic detectors, and you've got to have a siren that sets off. You've got to have hardwired to the fire department to be able to say, hey, there's a smoke alarm going off at this particular situation. Because it still takes the fire department, even if the fire department lives next door, it would still take them 5 to 7 minutes to get to your facility. And Glenn, the awful truth of looking at barn fires is they are usually on the ground in 12 minutes. You have 5 minutes to get your horses out. Mm-hmm. So you've got to have a way to tell that something's happening in that barn. And, you know, the case of the 22 horses that were recently removed from that other situation successfully shows that if somebody's there early and the fire department can get there early, you have a chance of saving all your animals. I think they lost one Arabian mare that had died of smoke inhalation. They managed to get the rest of them out. But if you look at those pictures on the website, they are leading those horses out after they have hosed down the barn. And that is that was very, very close. They came very close to losing all those animals too. Hundreds of animals every single year die in barn fires. And it's so simple. You would never, ever put your children in a daycare or in an elementary school that did not have sprinkler systems and fire detection. Why do we put our horses, people tell me they're their babies. If they're your babies, why are you putting them in a barn that does not have a detection system? And people say, well, I'm just a boarder. I can't make the owner do that. Oh, yes, you can. It's consumer driven. It is you demanding that this facility, if you're going to spend your money as a boarder in that facility, that you put your foot down and say, hey, I'm not going to spend my money in a place that does not have this. And actually, Dr. Becker just told me a story the other day. She had been putting her foot down years ago to a board facility where she was boarding her horse. They refused to buy a sprinkler system or even a smoke detector system. And I'm not talking $499 smoke detectors at Walmart. I'm talking about having a professional come in and put in a smoke detection system and a sprinkler system. And they refused to do it. She removed her horse, and about 3 weeks later, she said the place burned to the ground.
Oh my God.
And she said, I am so glad that I removed my horse from that facility. Awful. Well, the stories that people tell me.
I know I know your next guest has some experience with fires because he's out in the area that deals with them. Why don't you introduce him? He's ready to go.
Awesome. Willis Lamb out in Nevada. Did I say
Good
that
morning.
Right, Willis?
Only people that don't live in Nevada call it Nevada.
Well, we don't. We're safe then.
There you go.
Willis is a retired wildland firefighter from San Francisco Bay Area. He is a wild horse trainer and a mentor for people that are interested in wild horses. He's an all-around horseman. He has been advocating for educating horse and cattle owners in Nevada. How do you pronounce it?
Nevada.
Okay.
To better prepare themselves to deal with. Oh, you still got snow out there?
No, we don't. It's about 104.
Okay, I was going to say.
Anyway.
They've been dealing with wildfires and blizzards and other common disasters that befall owners in the western states. And, Glenn, when we talk about the western states, you know, those of us that live on the East Coast, we sort of take for granted that, you know, the fire department can get there in 5 to 7 minutes and that you can get somewhere within 20 minutes. Some of those states out there where they live, it takes a lot longer for emergency response, et cetera. Willis has been huge in working with these wild Mustangs, and he is the president of Least Resistance Training Concepts. He has been intimately involved with setting up a strike team that they use to respond to events ranging from domesticated horses loose in the road to wild Mustangs that have been injured by man-made activities. They recently had a mare that had stepped into a size 10 can
And can, yeah.
They had to get that off of her foot. I mean, there's always kind of... Tell us a few things that you do, Willa.
Oh, that's a new one.
Yeah, you know, horses can get into more trouble than you can imagine. I mean, you know, go do a response for a Belgian draft horse that's bogged in the middle of Lake Lahontan, and the only thing you can see is his head floating on somebody's inner tube that they paddled out to him so he wouldn't drown. I mean, we get a bunch of this stuff. However, where I want to go with this in the limited time we have, if I may, is that what has really changed the game here in northwestern Nevada over the last couple, 3 years is training. You know, we got a guy by the name of Mike Connell who was associated with the Joint Operations Center, which is run by the Department of Public Safety, who connected with Rebecca and the Talar training format and all the stuff that came along. I mean, we've done this for years, but we did it old school, you know, and he had the enthusiasm to get new people involved and get some of us old-timers to adopt some new ways of thinking, and it spread. You know, once we got the public safety people and search and rescue people and some other folks on board where we were all collectively on the same page, starting to make successes rather than reading the newspaper how, you know, somebody, you know, lost a bunch of horses and their grandmother in a fire because they didn't know what they, you know, what to do. So it was huge, and it really played out in the Bison Fire recently.
Tell us about that Bison Fire. I read your report, and I was very impressed with the apparent preparation level of your community.
Well, yeah. Well, actually, it wasn't our community. It was Smith Valley. You have to realize some of these western counties, it takes us more than an hour to get from the central county down to Smith Valley, which is our county. You know, we've got, as you indicate, large distances for everybody to travel in certain portions of these western states. Little town, 1,600 residents, Bison Fire, which, and it may hold. It could be that the fire down there at Mount Charleston is going to actually eclipse the size of the Bison Fire. But when the Bison Fire occurred, it was the largest wildfire ever, at least recorded, in northwestern Nevada. It might be the largest single fire. We've had bigger fires back east, but they were complexes where a bunch of little fires burned together. Nonetheless, here's this huge fire, 13-foot flame lengths, nearly 60 feet per minute being consumed, and the wind's driving it down on this little town of 1,600 residents, which is a farming community. They got a lot of livestock and livestock as pets, horses, alpacas, llamas, and so forth. The cool part is, because of the integration that took place as a result of training that was supported by the Division of Emergency Management, they were the facilitator to get this moving, and the curriculum that was developed by people like Rebecca and her group over there, Talar, everybody was on the same page. The county manager kept everybody briefed. We set up an information network that set broadcasts about three times a day to everybody that was involved, including the rescuers, the response team people. The search and rescue folks pretty much took control of and set up a command post for evacuation, which handled information to residents, coordination for placement of animals and things like that on the ground right there in Smith Valley. The rest of us were kept apprised. There were trigger points established. If a fire ran down this certain canyon past a certain trigger point, then that gave about a three-hour warning to a specific neighborhood that would have been affected that needed to be removed. We rolled out as soon as the fire reached the trigger point in what was called Pipeline Canyon. So we knew there was a very specific geographic area that was going to get removed. It took us a little over an hour to get down there. By the time we got down there, it was an amazing part. Two things happened. One is everybody had already made arrangements down there and they had their animals relocated. The search and rescue folks, we were standing by, the search and rescue folks went through the area three times, couldn't find a single animal that had been left behind because everybody had coordinated because of the mindset. You know, little tiny town, huge fire, it should have been a disaster that made the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times. The other thing is that there were lots of contingencies in place in the event that the fire started to spread through town. Now, that's where we were really going to get busy, as if it passed up their initial trigger point and threatened areas. So, you know, we were down there and we had it all set up. We had strike team, which is five similar pieces of equipment. These would be stock trailers. You can ordinarily take four animals. We've loaded out as many as 15 when we've had to. Obviously not full-size horses, but, you know, if we have a corral full of youngsters, we'll get what we need to get in the trailer and get them to safety. The community had a lot of self-help options other than the rodeo grounds, so that most horses that were relocated got to be in places where they were supervised once they were relocated. This was cool. You know, just the awareness, not the mindset that, well, it could happen, but I'll worry about that tomorrow. You know, it's just, hey, better worry about it now and get right ahead. It was a great example in how things can be coordinated and work effectively. And they work effectively because of the DEM, the Division of Emergency Management's attitude about this. It worked effectively because of Michael Connell and his energy in training people, getting them motivated. It worked because of good training methods. Well, you know, that gave us a bunch of fresh stuff to work with, you know, that not even us old-timers interested in it. The county manager, who also had a public safety background, was on top of this and understood the necessary components to save this town. And then finally, it was just sort of the grace of God. Just as the fire came roaring down on the town, the wind changed. And it was in an area that was accessible. All these pieces of apparatus were present that were going to try to beat this thing back. And within about an hour, this fire that we thought was going to last for another week or two got pretty much put to bed. And there were a lot of hot spots and things left over. But the threat was over. It was one of the most amazing stops I ever witnessed. And quite frankly, you know, we like to be called out when we're needed. And we were called out early enough that we weren't in one of these situations. And another concern is people call volunteer rescuers too late. The reflex time and the travel time is significant. We were there in time to actually do some work, but we got to watch a success story. You know, I mean, that rocks.
Well, Willis,
that is an awesome story.
I know it is. Let me ask you a question, though, and I want to follow up with something we talked about earlier in the show, is that people are people and they tend to put things off. What really motivated the entire town to get together? Was it because they knew they were in a path of a fire someday? It was just going to happen to them because it happens to everybody out there at some point. You know, but that's true of here in Florida, where, you know, hurricane is going to hit here and wipe out half the state at some point, but yet people aren't ready. I mean, why were the people there different than here?
I think there's a couple of things. One is, you know, in the Western landscape, we do have serious wildfires. In this case, this fire burned since July 4th from a lightning strike. So they got a chance to see it coming. Now, you see the hurricane coming, too. You don't really know where it's going to go. A wildfire is a little more predictable in some instances, depending upon the prevailing winds and the geography. So I think they had a much better sense that they were a target. The other thing is, it's more of a rural atmosphere. Rural people in general, not always, seem to be a little bit more self-sufficient. Right. Because of some, we just went out on a fire the week before in a little town called Silver City, and that was another one where, fortunately, it didn't go roaring up a canyon and take the town out, you know, so they got to see that Silver City was scrambling, and prior to that, we had fires in Reno that evacuated over 3,000 people, so, you know, it happens, I think, frequently enough here that it gets people's attention. It doesn't mean that every community is the same. We have some communities that are just, they aren't prepared. I'm sorry. It's just, you know, we're going to go in there, we're going to do the best we can, and it's not going to be very pretty at the end of it. And then you have other communities that, because of just the sense of what's going on, and again, we've had some very positive influences here. It may not have been the same 3 years ago, but with the influences that I previously described, you know, folks first taking this seriously, they had an idea of what to do. They had an idea of what the risks were. They had an understanding that protection starts with your own decision-making, you know, that the fire department's going to be busy fighting fire, not necessarily going to be looking after your animals, and the volunteers are going to do the best they can. But, you know, we're basically the cleanup crew. You know, what folks can't do for themselves. And, yeah.
Willis, that's why I wanted to have you on the show today, because I thought it was an absolutely fantastic story. And the reason it doesn't make the New York Times is because nobody died, nobody did any of those things. And I think that this is the kind of stuff that really ought to be on the front page of the newspaper, is huge successes like you guys had. And I'm very proud of all the work that you guys have put into that. Can you tell us a little bit about what you do with Least Resistance Training Concepts and the Wild Horses?
Sure. We started out about 1998 with a simple mission, and that was to try to get people to be more successful at adopted wild horses. They were getting hurt. Wild horses were getting hurt. They were, you know, if you didn't have a reasonable expectation of what to do when you took a wild horse home, you know, it was just really not such a good mix. So we worked with BLM, and we came up with a training curriculum that worked pretty well. And we really were deep into the wild horse thing. We still are. We go out on wild horse calls constantly. We just got to get some wild horses off the highway because one of the storms here took some highway fencing out. So we're used to dealing with those animals, and we're used to dealing with people. With my public safety background, you know, it kind of got left to us because we do a lot of wild horse transport, which means we have to load, be pretty skilled at loading horses that don't necessarily want to go into a trailer. it was just sort of segued into the rapid removal of domestic, or, you know, some of these domestic horses aren't all that tame either, you know, but the rapid removal of horses for emergencies. And because of that, we get involved in, you know, some very strange technical rescues. And then, wow, you know, again, the Division of Emergency Management said, hey, this is something we need to address and set up, you know, a program. And it just, it's sort of an interesting evolution, but I still have to say, and it's not like I'm trying to stump for Rebecca and her stuff, but having that material available and Nigel, the hard luck rescue horse, you know, we call him Nigel because he was made in England, and, you know, the mannequin, and, you know, just some of the stuff that really drew people's attention to this thing, you know, got a little publicity in the press. People got interested in taking training. And when they do that, there's this synergy that takes place where people either become more aware on how to self-help, or they become more aware how to do, how to not do something really stupid and to ask for the right help. So we're getting fewer people hurt and fewer horses hurt. And I think, you know, hey, that's pretty cool.
No, that's what it's
that's
all about.
Huge.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Well, Willis, we're running out of time here. I would love to have you back on the show sometime to talk more about least resistance training, and because that doesn't only apply to wild horses brought in off the plains, but our horses as well. So let's talk about that another time. We appreciate you being on. I'm sure we could hear 100 more stories of different things that you've dealt with emergency wise, and I would love to. It's so much fun. Where is there a website that you have? We could talk. Send
people to? If people want to see more information or what have you, on a variety of things, from the Wild Horse Help Desk for adopters to trying to protect your horse and livestock in the event of an emergency, there's a whole bunch of stuff. Go to WH Mentors, WH like Wild Horse, but it's the initial, WH Mentors, is it plural, .com. I'm sorry.
.org.
WH Mentors. .org.
Yep. WHmentors.org.
I don't even know the name of my own. I'm sorry.
No problem. Thank you, Willis.
Hey, what the heck?
We appreciate you getting up early to talk to us. Take care.
Okay. Bye.
Well, it was nice of him to get up in Nevada to talk to you. I bet you he has 100 more stories that would be fun to hear.
I have been told that I pronounce Nevada wrong every single time it says Nevada. I can't ever seem to get it right.
Well, we can never get your name right. So all the times
that's
you've
exactly
been on the
right.
show. All the Jimenez.
Yeah,
did I get that
I
right? Jimenez.
You got it right.
That's the first time ever, I think, I've ever said it right. Hey, I got one more thing here.
That's
we
okay.
have a couple of listeners that are posting on Facebook, and one of them, a regular listener of ours by the name of Uta, lives in Ohio, and she said there was a barn fire, a big barn fire up there. There's been a couple, actually. But she said the horses were turned out and ran into the burning barn because they associated it with being safe, and a bunch of them died.
That's I'm really surprised in that in the Arabian issue the other day, I'm really surprised that those horses didn't come back into the barn. That's what usually happens, is they run back into the barn if you cut them loose. The worst thing that can happen, just as Kelly Siegler mentioned, is you let them loose and they run down the road and they get hit by the fire truck. So then you got a double tragedy.
So if you shoo them out of the barn, make sure you somehow get the gate closed or the fence closed or something to keep them from getting back into the barn.
It's called a runout lane, and it actually has to be designed into your facility. You need to have it set up so that one or two gates can be either opened or closed to allow you to chase the horses out of the barn, close their stall doors after you let them out, close each stall door, and then you chase them out through the setup lane and chase them out to a pasture or a paddock that's way away from the barn so that the firefighters can deal with the barn fire and trying to save whatever else is salvageable after you've got the horses out.
Back in Kentucky, if you remember back, every single barn there is built so that there is a complete fence all the way around the barn. Only about 20 feet away from the barn, but it goes all the way around. And there's a gate directly at the end of the aisle, so you can open one gate, open every stall door, and judge the horses out as you go down the aisle, and then close one gate, and the horses cannot get back to the barn.
Exactly. That's what you're supposed to do.
It's a really, really simple design, but boy, is it effective in emergency.
It is. And the other thing that amazes me, Jennifer, is that there's so many people that have a property, and they do not have a gate or a fence in front of their property to the road. So if you get an animal out, I mean, you could be holding the horse for the farrier and he can get loose, much less a barn fire. He gets loose and runs forward. Why don't they have fences and gates to keep animals from getting loose on general everyday incidents? I think Kelly Siegler pointed out, it is your responsibility legally. If your horse gets hit by somebody in the road, they can sue you. You technically have allowed an e-stray. That's the fancy name for it. It's an e-stray. And there's a lot of laws in every single state that regulate loose livestock, loose horses that get out into the road.
Yeah. Very interesting. And I'm reading some of the other comments too. And, you know, you could think, you know, I'll just close the barn doors, but the barn doors are going to burn off the barn. I mean, you know, they may not be there in another couple minutes. So that's
what's interesting, Glenn, is over the years, one of the things that we've realized that's more important than anything else is when you're building a barn, most barns have the barn doors for each stall point to the inside aisle.
Right.
Because that's what we normally use for feeding and removing poop and all this kind of thing.
It makes it easier, yeah.
But for evacuation, you need to have a stall door that also points to the outside. That way you don't have to go down the interior aisle. The interior aisle is where the rafters, when they break, when the smoke is in there, et cetera, that you're not going to be able to survive going down the interior aisle. So we've realized over the years that if you don't have a runout lane, you should at least have access to the outside of each stall to be able to get those horses out.
And a lot of barns, especially the older barns, don't have that. Now, I did notice, Jennifer, in Kentucky, a lot of the barns did have that too. They would have the both doors. One to the inside.
You are not allowed, as a human being, you are not allowed to go in a public facility that does not have two doors out.
That's true.
And why would we do that to a horse? We don't give them two doors out. And so you only have one way out, and people think, well, I have two doors at the end of the barn. Well, that's not what we're talking about. We're talking to his living space. You need to have access to both sides. And honestly, that helps you not only for barn fires, but it also helps you for situations where the animal ends up getting cast in the stall. That's a very common TLR situation where the animals – it helps you with trying to get the horse uncast. It also helps you, God forbid, the horse dies in the stall. It's difficult to get a horse out of a stall if you only have one stall door and it goes to the interior aisle. It's much easier to get a dead horse out of a stall from the outside wall.
And on that note, get your chainsaws out, everybody. Have a good day with your chainsaws.
But we all know there's, 9.2 million horses in the United States right now, and over the next 30 years, 9.2 million horses are going to die. So
that's
we
true.
Need to prepare for that part, too.
Well, this has been absolutely fascinating. I'm so glad that we're able to do this. I'm looking forward to it once a month, and judging by the comments we're starting to get on Facebook here, I think people are, too. You know, we want to, I think in future episodes, as I mentioned earlier in the show, we're going to get into, going to cover specific things that you can do and try and give you more practical, hands-on things that you can take away from the show and actually do and practice and make sure are correct. So we'll be doing a lot more of that. Is there anything else you want to mention about shows coming up? Taking calls. We do want calls, right?
Oh, absolutely. We love calls because that, you know, even though it's sort of the shiny penny thing, oh, well, look at this. We can go talk about that. We will try to keep a theme in every single show. But, of course, your questions are welcome. You can post them to us via Facebook. You can call into the radio show. We'd love to hear from you bright and shining in the morning. Any way you want to get a hold of us, we will try to answer your questions. And if I don't know, I will find somebody that does know.
And where can people find you again?
They can find me at TLAER.org, or they can call me at 214-679-3629. Speaking of calling, you know what's really weird, Glenn? We got a phone call years ago from a guy that had a deer down in the middle of a well, and it was a fire chief. And he said, how can I get the deer out of the middle of the well? He was about 60 feet down. And Tomas answered the call, and he said, can you fill it with water? They did. They floated the deer to the top. They were able to fish him out very successfully. So, of course, I end up answering phone calls that are sort of strange, but that's okay.
I would have never thought about that. Well, thank you again, Dr. G. We really appreciate you joining us. We'll be back here on Horses in the Morning live tomorrow morning. Jamie will be here for Really Bad Ads. Don't forget to get your Really Bad Ads in to Jennifer at horseradionetwork.com. And I know I'm just going to go over real quickly here for our sponsors, that we have an Ultra Shield Fly Protection Package for one of the winners. We have Uncle Jimmy's Gift Pack, and also Kat from the Eat Your Tart Out blog, the terrific food blog that makes me hungry every single day, has a 6-pack of cupcakes in a jar, which we talked about on the show. She's going to send them out to one of our listeners who wins Really Bad Ads tomorrow. So get them in to Jennifer at horseradionetwork.com. That's it for today. We'll talk to you again next month, Dr. G.
Thank you so much, Glenn.
See everybody. Be safe. Wear your helmets. Don't.
All a professional.
Yeah, and fence your pools in. Put a pool. Don't put your horses out where there's a pool.
Fence your graves in.